and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, a weekly podcast hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Full of Beans is here to share the unheard voices of those who are living with, supporting, researching, or working in the field of eating disorders. Each conversation aims to bring a different perspective and understanding so that together we can learn, advocate, and connect to realise we are not alone in our struggles and that recovery is possible. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. And just a gentle reminder that these episodes are not a replacement for therapeutic support. So if you are struggling, please do reach out and know that there will always be someone there to listen. And finally, thank you to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital, for your continued support. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Ailey Musgrave, whose story spans years of misdiagnosis, medical trauma, and inspiration to never give up hope on someone's recovery journey. Ailey has experience of 9 inpatient admissions for anorexia, experiencing severe depression, self-harm, multiple surgeries, sepsis, and temporary paralysis. Throughout her treatment, Ailey also received a diagnosis of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and autism, both of which helped explain so much of what had been misunderstood. Now back in education and working as an expert by experience, Ailey campaigns passionately for safer, more compassionate care, from speaking in the House of Commons to challenging the assisted dying bill alongside leading researchers. Ailey's message is clear. No one with anorexia should be turned away from life-saving treatment, and no one should be dying for treatment. This episode with Ailey was incredibly inspiring. After everything she has been through, the fact that she is now putting that experience to campaign for others so that they don't experience similar things is absolutely incredible. It's also a recognition to the fact that no matter what situation somebody is in or how long they've been struggling, as clinicians and as people working in the eating disorder space, we need to hold on to hope that recovery is completely possible. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Ailey Musgrave and I am incredibly excited to speak to her today. So thank you so much for joining me, Ailey. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Hannah. How are you?
Yes, I'm doing very well, thank you. I feel very honoured to speak to you. When I reached out to you and I was like, don't worry if you can't speak to me for months because I'm sure you're going to be very busy with your new campaign. So it's lovely to have you.
Thank you.
So did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yes. So hi, everyone. I'm Ailey Musgrave. At the moment, I'm a full-time student studying social science and humanities and hoping to go into the police. But it's taken me about 16 years to get to that place. And that's because when I was 13, I was diagnosed and hospitalised with anorexia. I was initially struggling with significant gastrointestinal issues since I was 12, but they were all inconclusive, like the tests and things that people did, and my mum reached out to a lot of people. But because of those symptoms of like feeling sick and feeling full, I just sort of cut down what I was eating, and my weight got to a point where my cognition sort of just started shutting down. So I stopped going to school. I was very anxious all the time, and it culminated in needing to go to A&E. And sort of then that sort of turned into a bit of a landslide for the next 14 years, which was a relapse and repeat cycle. And generally, I think that going into hospital that first time certainly sort of conditioned me in anorexia. It exposed me to mental health, which I hadn't come across really before. I never self-harmed before I went to hospital, and I saw people doing it. I was like, oh, well, they all seem like super calm after they've done that, so I'm going to try that. And, you know, that then sort of started that whole spiral. And then because I think I was not acknowledged in my gastrointestinal difficulties, I was also an undiagnosed autistic for 3 of those first years. I was diagnosed when I was 15, and so all of that was just the like a melting pot of trauma, depression, despair, everything. And so I just had absolutely no idea what life was. I stopped going to school. So going back into college now is just the most incredible and also scary thing. And, you know, I lost all my friends. So I was totally unsocialized. And then after sort of screaming for about 7 years at people saying, I really don't feel well, I was finally diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is multisystemic connective tissue disorder. And really my type, there's 13 subtypes, but my type primarily affects the gastrointestinal system, which I'd been telling people since I was 12. But they're so difficult to kind of come up on normal tests. And it wasn't till later on, I actually had to have 3 open surgeries in the period of 18 months. The surgeon's just like, you're an absolute mess inside. Like, nothing's where it's supposed to be. Nothing looks right. Nothing's looks like normal. And it was like, it took about 14 years for me to actually finally feel validated that my struggles were real. And, you know, so now I'm kind of 2 years since my last hospital admission. I'd had 9, I think, in total admissions in those 13 years. And my last one was 4 years straight under a section 3. So leaving with essentially no support, it took about 7 months for a community appointment. It was scary, but I embraced it. And then I kind of moved from supported living to independent living. Now I'm moving in with my partner. It's like just all of these things I never thought were at all possible have all just happened. I'm thinking about going to university. It feels weird because it's normal, is how my dad put it. It's like, it's great, but it feels weird because you're doing normal things and that's weird. So I think that's a fair introduction, would you say, Hannah?
Absolutely. I mean, that, what an inspiring story of everything you've been through and held on to, you know, keep pushing and saying, I know that the treatment I'm not getting is not right and I know that there's something more. And now to be in the position that you are, you know, moving in with your partner at college, going off to, I mean, that is just absolutely incredible. And I think it speaks a lot. I know we're going to come on to this later, but, you know, with the topic that we're talking about in terms of eating disorders and maybe the hope that disappears at a certain point for people, you know, you are living proof that that hope really needs to be held on to, because there is a future no matter how long you've been struggling or to what severity you get to.
Exactly. And I think for so long throughout it was my mum and my family who held that hope, because I had just thrown it all out the window. I was like, there's no point even trying, it's not going to work. So, you know, it's real thanks to my mum, who really was the one who's got me through to be able to be in a position that I am now. So,
yeah, well, that's amazing. You know, thank you to your mum for holding on to that. Before we move on to talking about the campaign that you've been involved in, the Dying for Treatment campaign, I want to ask you about your admissions, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So you said, did you say 9 or 13? Is it 9 or 13 years?
Like, I think it's 9 in 13 years, yes. Yeah.
Did they differ in any way in terms of the treatment that you had as you went through those different admissions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the admissions during the child and adolescent period, so up to the age of 18, they were very different to the adult admissions, very much more set up to try and actually support people. There were a lot of different types of kind of activity or support workers or therapy workers. You know, kind of there was drama and dance therapy, music therapy, just a lot more like stability and consistency. And then moving into the adults, it was almost like they were like, well, you're an adult now, you should be able to sort yourself out. And there was a very stark difference in sort of the way that people behave towards me. So even though I was an adult, I think I was probably 3 weeks an adult and had been expected that I would totally act totally differently. Add in the kind of autistic element where I had meltdowns, which people just mistake for as tantrums or just getting angry and annoyed that I'm not getting my way. So that was different as well. But then sort of between looking at the NHS and private places as well, the thing that was the same through them all was just a total misunderstanding of where I was coming from with my eating disorder. A kind of, you know, everything that I said or did was because of my eating disorder. They didn't really understand that the autism, even with the diagnosis, would have an impact, or that the physical health illness, once it was diagnosed, even like that still wasn't allowed to even come into the mix, and very difficult in terms of making those reasonable adjustments, and as well that misunderstanding around autism or neurodiversity as well, and like that a meltdown is just a tantrum and you need to be held down when you're having your meltdown because that's going to fix it all. Yeah, there wasn't really much positive risk taking ever anywhere. You know, it's kind of very much on the restriction side, and not really anything was particularly patient-centered. I think that's become a total buzzword, and I know people try, but it's all there is. I've not come across a place that is person-centered, because at the end of the day, being upheld to the policies and powers of the hospital and like directing board, and that in itself just is making it an inability to be patient-centered.
Absolutely. And I mean, I totally agree with you in terms of the buzzword. I personally think person-centered or individualized care, neuro-informed and trauma-informed have just become buzzwords that people like to use because it makes them seem informed in that. But actually, you know, what does that actually mean? And I think when it comes down to it, when it boils down to it, even things like neuro-informed or trauma-informed, it's about seeing the patient across from you and understanding what they need in that moment. And as you say, I think unfortunately with the way that the system is currently set up, there's not always that flexibility or that ability to give people exactly what they need in that moment, which I think is then what leads to a lot of the time patients like yourself going back into hospital after an admission, because I'm making an assumption here, but I would love for you to say what your experience was. But I think often people are discharged before they're maybe ready, because there's not enough funding, there's not enough beds, there's not enough resources, which then puts people out in quite a vulnerable position, not knowing what they're supposed to do next.
Yeah. And I think as well, adding to that, the community provisions, there's a lot of the same issues that we come across as an inpatient. It's the same in outpatients, but just without the hospital. So the community teams are often, they still don't know how to, like, they're not neuro-informed or trauma-informed. And I mean, initially, after my very first discharge, it was like nobody knew what Section 117 aftercare was. So I didn't actually get the care that I was legally entitled to, because nobody knew what was Section 117. What are we supposed to do? Well, how can we do that? And it was just like, it was such a stretch, and they didn't respond. A lot of like hospitals and the trust, it said around interventions instead of prevention. So one time I was discharged and they said, oh, we're not going to give you DBT, even though it's a really good therapy and would probably work for you, because you're not currently displaying these risk behaviours that DBT helps with. So it was like, okay, great. So you're just going to wait until I display the behaviours, you know, and then you'll intervene, but you won't intervene because by then you won't have enough money and I'll have to wait 14 weeks for an assessment and then another like 5 months until a therapist's available, by which time I am on the floor and you can't help me at all, is essentially how it went.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that is one of the massive problems. Like you say, it's waiting till it's all burst without actually putting anything preventative in. In terms of your treatment that you had, to think a bit more about the Dying for Treatment campaign, Why is that campaign something that's so close to your heart?
I think because I was always labelled complex. So I was the one who had too much going on. So it was just too hard to actually treat. I think I had somebody send me home from an inpatient under section two after 3 days, telling my parents, well, she's a bit more complex than her community team led us to believe. So it was left to my parents to then drive me all the way back from Glasgow, because they'd driven me all the way up there 3 days before. So that's one part, I think, as well. The difficulty accessing the treatment in the first place. I was admitted, and I was at this point then under a section three, but then the general psychiatric ward sort of ignored the eating disorder, and they were sort of like, well, we're here to treat the suicidal thoughts, so, you know, we can't do anything about that. But then they moved me so that then the nearby eating disorder unit couldn't do their support. The consultant refused entry to my community eating disorder team. So I was left in the dark on my own in this place. I was then too dehydrated. So he said, you're not medically fit to stay here. You have to go up to the big medical hospital. At which point, when I'd gone up there, the medical doctors then said, well, you're not going back to that place because they got you in this state in the first place. So then I had to stay there. But then they said, oh, but we don't want to do restraints and stuff, so you can stay here, but we won't, you know, feed you or like hydrate you because you don't want that. So that's fine. So then I was there for a month. And I think I had someone sitting in the room all the time watching, but that was about all they were doing. Again, it was down to my mum coming in and out every single day just to sort of keep me fit enough to stay alive behind the scenes. I think my community team had over 20 hospitals say, no, we won't take her. By which point they'd gone looking outside of my home area. So this was out of an area. And then after, I think, 5 months, of which we were trying to find somewhere, somebody came and said, yeah, we'll take her. We'll sort that out. So then it took, if you think about this, and this was somebody who was already in the system. So it wasn't even like I had to get myself onto a record here. I was in the system waiting 5 months, 20 rejections, like over 20 rejections, by which point we don't know how I was still alive, but I was. And I know if that person hadn't said yes, then I probably wouldn't be here. And I think that the treatment and the accessibility for treatment and the postcode lottery and the like sort of inability for teams to know how to help the, I'm using finger quotes here, complex patients like me, that all of that is culminating to a point where patients are being put onto palliative care pathways because there's not the funding, or there's not the people confident enough to say yes, or they've exhausted all of their eligibility for treatment. I don't even know why it is they're doing this. So then I think I've forgotten where I've started all of this, but it's, you know, it's all of those things is that why it is such a risk to have the sort of the assisted dying bill as it stands, with the potential for somebody with anorexia to access assisted death. Because as you know, as we know, it affects the body as well as the mind. It's not the only mental illness that does this. This is just, you know, this is just my area of expertise, as you would like to say. And it's very, very easy for kidney failure, liver failure, any sort of organ failure, multi-organ failure to happen with anorexia. And that in itself could be this loophole that has been talked about. And so for me, knowing if this bill existed when I was at that point, waiting in the hospital with my mum coming in every day, and I'd known about it and I'd have accessed it, then I wouldn't be here now. you know, and going into college and thinking of uni and moving in with partner and all of these wonderful things that we talked about at the start. And I want, you know, I'm speaking out about it because I don't want, I want people who are maybe in the place where I was or in any sort of place with their eating disorder, I don't want them to be able to not experience this amazing part of life and this hope when it comes back. So I guess you could say that is probably why it is very close to my heart.
I would say that is a very good reason for it to be so close to your heart. And, you know, thank you so much for sharing your story. I have a lot of questions, so I'm just going to try and hold myself back. I think the one question that's kind of come into my mind mostly is, when you were in that position, I know you said that if the palliative carer or the assisted dying bill was available, you wouldn't be here. When you were in that position after not being able to find a hospital to take you, was there any part of you that wanted to recover, or was it all just, I don't want this anymore?
I think a bit of both, because a lot of the struggles with my anorexia had been that I just wanted it to end. It wasn't always that I wanted life to end or that I wanted to die. I just didn't want anorexia. I didn't want the illness because it was so painful and so incredibly, it was just torture to live that way. And I just wanted that to end, but I knew it couldn't end if I wasn't getting the support that I needed. So there was no other way for it to end unless I ended. So sometimes, yes, sometimes I was full on like, there is no ability for recovery. There is absolutely nothing. I'm giving up. But there was always that little voice that was just like, but what if? Like, what if there is a possibility? And so it was just, I just wanted the illness gone. And I couldn't see a way to do that on my own. And I was on my own. So, yeah, I mean, I just wanted that to end. I wanted the pain to stop.
And another thing that I've been thinking as you've been talking, so I'm going to paraphrase this with, this is not my perspective, this is perspectives I've heard. And I think that it's always interesting to bring in different perspectives. So I think there's clinicians who maybe have worked or been supporting patients with anorexia who have had years and years of treatment, and they feel like they've exhausted the treatment options that are available, and the patient is in a lot of distress. At that point, do you think that palliative care or assisted dying could be something to consider? Or is there another option that you would think of?
That's a really interesting question. And I want to answer it right. So I'm just going to take a minute. I wonder, first of all, whether the clinician has asked the patient, the person they're working with, what they feel might help them. I think a lot of the time, clinicians are the ones dictating how treatment goes, and they forget to listen to the patient's voice. And I wonder if they have done that in this instance, because I think my experience was just being ordered about. And I think that in itself is very distressing. And I think taking the time to be less of a dictator, and I think more of a collaborator with the patient, is one aspect that they could try.
I think I personally, you know, I think it's a very difficult position, and I'm not saying that, you know, I would want to be in those clinicians' shoes, because I think it's a very difficult position to be in. But I think, you know, your story is testament to the fact that even after years of trying different things, there will be something that will be supportive for that person that they're working with. And I guess with that in mind, was there something specific for you that changed when you kind of constantly, you know, were going down that cycle and re-engaging with the eating disorder, what was it that made a difference?
In my last admission, they brought on a learning disability and autism nurse who also had extensive background in eating disorders. So that part was helpful because he could say to people, well, she's actually telling the truth, guys. Like, the things that she's telling you is related to her autism are about her autism. It's not because she's finding different excuses not to eat and drink. So that was one thing. Trust and building trusting relationships. There was a very, very constant nurse in my care in those 4 years. And without him, I don't know if, I mean, I still might have got to this stage, but I might not. He was brilliant, and he actually got to know me. So he could sort of help his staff understand what not to do with me. And I think even then, there was obviously still a lot of time of struggle. And I turned around to the learning disability and autism nurse, and I said to him one day, I said, I think the only way I'm going to get out of this is if I do it myself, because I'm not going to get anyone else to, no one else is going to be able to help you. And I think from that moment, I think things changed. I think when I look back, all the other times that I got discharged, I was doing everything that I was doing because I was told to, and because I could leave once I'd reached certain markers. And I think what changed the last time and why I'd not been readmitted was because I did it for myself, and I did it myself. And I think that's a really important distinction for me to see, that my recovery only happened when it was my decision. And it took a really, really long time, but at least I got there and it's sort of stuck. And that's not to say there's not struggles afterwards. I think I'll always have that default setting when things are hard to let the anorexia in a bit more. But I think I am in a much stronger position where I can catch it and recognize it sooner and do things to change that and support myself out of it. And it helps now because I've seen what life's like. I'm like, right, I know what's possible. I'm not going to do this again. I mean, it was something as simple as a Christmas wreath that got me out of one funk, you know, because it related to a whole thing that had been happening. So it was, yeah, doing it for myself. And that was a big part of it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I welled up when you were talking. Aww. Because I have never been able to find the words for what you have just said. But I think for me, my recovery was exactly the same. And it sounds, you put it so beautifully. I feel like when I say it, I'm really diminishing the kind of impact or the severity an eating disorder can have. But I had the same thing of 14 years of in and out of treatment. And then I connected with a therapist and finally felt seen. You know, they understood me and they held me and held on to that hope. And then all of a sudden one day I thought, I'm going to do this. And it sounds, when you say it like that, it sounds like, oh, you just decide that you're going to recover. And I don't mean that to kind of say, you know, you just need to make that decision, because it actually has to come from like it makes me think of the Polar Express, when he actually believes and then he can finally hear the bell. And it's like, oh, you have to fully want, or you have to fully say, I'm going to do this now. And I think that's the key. And unfortunately for clinicians listening, that's not something that you can just prescribe, or that's not something that you can just say. It's something that you have to work with somebody, and it can take a really, really long time, but it can happen. And what you were saying earlier about your mum was the one person that held on to hope. I personally think that's the main responsibility of a clinician. It's obviously to support you and to make sure you're stable, but to hold on to that hope that recovery is possible, I don't think anything else is as powerful as that.
Yeah, I agree. And it's so hard because I can see a lot of them do care. And it's almost like they're sort of throwing everything at me or at us to be like, try this. Why isn't it working? But sometimes it's reeling all of it back and just being with somebody, like just sitting with them. And that's hard because that takes time, which clinicians and nurses and, you know, support workers really don't have the time for in their day, in the wards, in the hospitals, in the community. But time was probably for me better than any medicine. Like, just, you know, don't just tell me that you're going to like force feed me after half an hour if I haven't finished my food. Just take the extra time. And then it's like, there's just so much. Taking time shows care. It shows like love. It shows value. It shows importance. It's not a clock watching, you know, come on, I've got to fit somebody else in kind of thing, which just is just like, okay, well, you don't care about me, so I don't care about me either, so let's go. So yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's such a key part there, is it's seeing the person for the person that they are and showing them, as you said, that you do care. Because I think I definitely thought, if you don't have hope for me getting better, how the hell am I supposed to have it? Because yeah, you're the professional, you're the one helping me. So, you know, I think it's not an easy thing at all. But I think it's ever so important to hold that space for people and to give them that space to get better. Another thing that I've sometimes heard from clinicians and also people that have been, you know, in that position where they say that assisted dying is something that they would consider, is that the process of recovery would be so incredibly difficult and horrible to experience that they would rather end their life than to go through that. I just wondered if you had anything that you would respond to that.
I can certainly relate. And I can say it's true. Recovery is really painful. The idea of going against every instinct in the brain is very, very, very distressing, which can then make other things worse. I remember in my recovery, it's the self-harm would get worse because I had to find a way. I was like, it was one thing or another. It was either I don't eat and I feel okay, or I eat and I do the recovery thing, but then I have to hurt myself because it's too much. I can't deal with it. And I think that, yes, it's painful and yes, it's horrible. And yes, it would be so much easier to end a life than to go through that. I mean, my mum herself said at that worst point, she could understand why I wanted to die, because she could see how much pain I was in, not just physically, but emotionally and mentally. She could see that, and she thought it would just be kinder. And for a mum to say that takes a lot of pain for her. And I think that knowing that there are people there to support you, knowing that there are people along the way, whether it's family or not, you know, having a clinician who is committed to seeing this through for you, someone who is there for you, and just instead of trying to see an end goal, which I was and probably still am an absolute terrible one to do, and forget all the steps in between. It's taking that one step at a time. It's probably such a cliche by now. And I think that you know, instead of kind of, I don't know, thinking ahead to the, like, oh my God, the dinner today is just the most terrifying thing. It's the three of my fear foods. It's awful and I hate it and I can't do it. It's kind of thinking, okay, right, I've just woken up, it's time to brush my teeth. And it's slowing down that brain and living in this very current minute. And that is the hardest thing to do when our brains try and trick us by, there's all of those special words, isn't it? They're like black and white thinking or catastrophizing and all of those things that we can do so easily. And I think I'm waffling and I don't know if I've answered your question. Yes, it's painful. Yes, it will take time. One step at a time, be there for someone, do what you can. And what you can do is the best you can do at that moment. And that is enough.
You didn't waffle at all, honestly. Everything that you're saying, I'm just like, I want to put quotes everywhere around the world. And I don't know whether it's a neurodivergent thing or what, but I still struggle with the whole end goal stuff now. Like, if people say to me, what are your goals for the future? I'm like, I can't think of the ways to get there, so I can't think of the goal in the future. But equally, when you do think of like a goal that you want to have or a place you want to be, the thought of getting there feels incredibly impossible. So I think what you've said about taking those small steps for whatever feels manageable, you know, if at the start of recovery that is going minute by minute, that is absolutely fine, and over time that will build. And I remember when I was struggling, I used to do these exercise routines, and my friend said to me, just reduce it by a second. Mm. And I was like, that's ridiculous. What's the point in doing that? And he was like, honestly, try it. Could I do it? I could not. And then I managed to do the second. And then he said, okay, next time I want you to do 2 seconds. And it felt like the most stupid thing in the world. But then after 2 seconds, I was like, I can do 10 seconds. And then I did 15, and then I built on that. And then all of a sudden you're in this position where you're like, whoa, I've now done something completely different. And I would never thought this would even be possible. But taking those small steps, I think, I don't know about you, but for me, it meant that I wasn't throwing myself into fear. I was doing things that felt manageable, which then were also maintainable.
Mm, yeah, definitely. I think it might be my sort of, maybe it's a neurodivergent brain as well, but it's that kind of thing where it's like, oh, hang on a minute, I've just done something I never thought possible. And I'll be like, I'll just cut it in half now. So remember the first time that I decided to eat in my first admission, and they were like, okay, so we'll start with a snack. Nope, I'm doing it all, I've made my decision, give it to me, give everything. And it was like, my dad calls me the girl who runs before she can walk, and I still do it today. It's just, I think it's just something that will probably always be in me. But as long as I'm doing it towards the right things, then it's okay.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And I think that is something I've definitely found, is that a lot of the traits that maybe made me vulnerable to an eating disorder, now being able to see them and use them in a positive light, I found is such a beautiful kind of switcheroo. Because yes, it caused pain and suffering, but now it's doing great things. And it sounds like you're the same, you know, with heading off to college and university and everything. So mm-hmm. That's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
You did mention your mum. Mm-hmm. And one thing I wanted to ask, obviously you might not want to speak for her, but maybe you could discuss, you know, if there's anything that she said to you. How did your admissions impact her?
They were extremely traumatic, and she couldn't show her emotions. She had to be there for me 100% all the time, showing up. I was before her for everything. And I think the effects are being felt now, where it's like she's started therapy, so she's having to slowly unpack her trauma, and that, you know, the trauma of seeing her daughter try and take her life, and seeing her daughter self-harming, and as well as the things where if I would argue back at her, she had to bite her tongue, because she knew if she argued back to me arguing back, then I would like just go absolutely woo, 100%. And she just couldn't handle it. So I think she's probably now learning to find her tongue, and which is great. I love it. It's good for her. And trying to learn not to put me first for everything. And now I'm aware of her inclination to still do that and tell her things like to put herself first. So I think my pickup time was like 20 minutes earlier than I was expecting, and she was going to pick me up, and then the pickup time changed. So I told her the change in pickup time, but said, you know, don't worry, you don't have to come now. It's fine. You do what you were going to do. Don't stop your plans. Like, because I want her to learn that she can put herself first as well, and try and make her do that when she's still inclined to put me first. So, but for my parents both, it was horrific. But my mum was around more because dad was working, and I think his way of dealing with it was probably working for longer, and just sort of staying away. But my mum from the start was like, anorexia is not going to destroy the family. It is not going to rip us apart. And she stuck to that promise. So when I think I banned them from visiting, she said, that's fine if you don't want to see me, but I'm still just going to come and I'm going to sit there. And I think after like the second week, I think the 5 minutes before visiting ended, I started to coming out and coming to see them. So yeah, she's a very determined woman. I think that's where I probably get a lot of it from.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important part of the conversation, because often I think family members are maybe forgotten about, and, you know, it does completely throw the family's world upside down. And I think, you know, not only having the support there for patients, but making sure that there's that support for parents as well. Because, you know, it's amazing that your mum said, you know, I'm still going to come no matter what you're saying. Because I've heard countless parents, but well, they don't want us there, so we're not going to visit. And I don't know whether you were the same, but I know that I, when I was struggling, said a lot of things that maybe the eating disorder was saying rather than what Hannah was saying. So just communicating things like that to parents, say, she may not want to see you. It might not actually be that she doesn't want to see you, but just remember that she's being driven by a lot of things at the moment. So do you think there's anything in particular that your treatment team did or could have done that would have been supportive for your family?
The silence is not doing very good, is it? I think things that weren't very good were that when I was having my meltdowns, they would call my parents to come and sort it out. Because, well, A, because my mum was very, they live very close by. I think also that, I mean, I don't know why they chose to do it and not tried. Maybe they did try and it wasn't responding, but it was just like, she's having another meltdown, can you come down here and sort her out, kind of thing. So putting more of a burden on my mum very much didn't help. So, you know, something that they could have done was sort of actually inquire about, okay, well, how what normally works really, what kind of helps her calm down, bring herself back, you know, what do you do that we could try and do? Something like that. I mean, it's very good now that there's a, say, in physical health hospitals, there's a kind of leniency with people who are neurodivergent, so that the visiting hours don't have to be adhered to. So it's like my parents were able to come in quite a lot because of the sort of reasonable adjustments. But I think with visiting hours in the hospitals, it's stricter for good reason. And I think that they kind of might have to sort of then maybe stick by their own rules a bit more and say, well, we do have these visiting hours. Ailey's having a meltdown, it's not in the visiting hour, so let's not get her mum down here. But then also at the same time, if someone's resource is family, or family animals are a great one, then, you know, it's kind of actually, all right, well, it seems like they're going on holiday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and visiting is not till 7, they would miss it that day for another 2 weeks. So, you know, maybe we could get them in a bit earlier so she can say goodbye and see the dog or whatever. Things like that. It's kind of learning when to bend the rules and learning when to sort of be a bit stricter with them. Listening to parents and carers. They know so much about patients, so much about people. and the voice is often shut down or not listened to or even ignored and not thought of when sort of making care plans or thinking of, right, someone's really struggling right now, we're a bit stuck. I mean, apart from the patient being the best source of self-knowledge, it is the immediate people to them. It might not always be family, it might be carers, it might be partners, it might be friends if somebody is estranged from family members. So it's actually kind of accepting that the professional voice might not always be the most knowledgeable in a room or in a situation.
I think, you know, you're so right. And I do think, as well as also just providing that support at the end of the day, like you said, it's a very traumatic thing to watch a loved one experience an eating disorder. And I think sometimes it can sort of become the patient versus the clinician versus the parents. And actually, everybody's trying to do the same thing. Maybe they're going a little bit different ways. But I think, you know, coming together and supporting each other can be really, really useful. So thank you so much for sharing your story. You are absolutely incredible. And it's amazing that you are now sharing your story to help other people, because I can't wait to share this episode. I know it's going to be one that clinicians are, well, I really hope, listen to, because I think you've provided such amazing insights. So
thank you
so much. If people want to get involved with the Dying for Treatment campaign, is there anything they can do?
So there is the video to share. There are open letters. There's some to the MPs and there's some to Lords. It's all about like reaching out and getting that information to people about why we're doing this and what this is. I think there's probably a lot of misunderstanding that we're trying to shut down the bill. There's, you know, sharing experiences and using the hashtag.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. And yeah, just best of luck with everything, because you're doing amazingly. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice. So please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.